if I compare the ocean flying or the quality ocean flying in the Caribbean and the tropical islands on a technical difficulty level, if you want to apply a scale like that, the Alaska flying is just in a different world altogether. From a float flying perspective, take away the terrain and take away the weather elements, just the water state, the condition of the water surfaces, and the tidal movement in parts of Alaska is extreme.
G'day and welcome everyone to episode number 17 of On The Step With That Mallard Guy. I'm your host, seaplane mad enthusiast and Grumman Mallard captain, Dan Bolton. Welcome to another week talking all things seaplanes. I've still got a hangover from last week's great episodes, Shane and his 3 years off the airlines, chasing the seaplane dream, and Michael and Stuart talking all about their private Grumman Albatross, which after posting about it on Instagram came news to me that it's actually listed for sale on Controller. Funny they didn't mention that, but there you go. Folks, to get in touch and say hello, maybe you've got a suggestion for a future guest, maybe you just want to tell me how much you're loving the pod, or maybe you just want to say a cheerful hello, you can email me at thatmallardguy@hotmail.com or on my Instagram at thatmallardguy. Also, if you love the show and want to hear more stories from floatplane and flying boat pilots around the world, give me a 5-star review on the platform you're listening on, especially via Apple Podcasts. I get asked a lot about how people who listen via Spotify can help out the show by leaving a review. Unfortunately, at this stage, Spotify doesn't have a review system, but it may well do so in the near future. So for now, if you want to help me out, you'll have to jump on your iPad to review, which I know a few people have done, and that's much appreciated. Now, we have so much to get through on today's episode, so we're going to jump straight into it with another great guest. When you think of dream places to fly seaplanes, you can't go past Alaska. And my guest today, Dion Mitten, captures that dream so perfectly with his incredible photography and videography he posts on his numerous social media channels. Everyone in the seaplane industry would have seen Dion's work in some way or another, whether it is via his Instagram channel at Dion Mitten, his YouTube channel under his name, or if you're a subscriber to his aviation photography newsletter via his website, dionmitten.com. I certainly am. His photos capture perfectly the incredible scenery on offer throughout Alaska and other parts of the world Dion has operated. Not only is he great at using a camera to tell stories, he's also good at using a microphone as well. It's time, folks, to walk down to the seaplane base at Lake Hood. Grabbing out our camera of choice, we'll adjust our zoom and shutter speed to perfectly capture the next floatplane getting on the step.
Right engine is turning. 12% fuel. A lot.
Okay, welcome on the line, Dion Mitten. How are you going, mate?
Hey, good morning, Dan. Thank you for having me. Very good morning from out of Africa.
Yeah, good morning for you, maybe. It's evening time here now. Mate, but yeah, very good to have you on the show, mate, on the step. You're a bit of a podcast expert. You've been on a lot of shows now, but I really like to focus on some of the Alaskan flying that you're doing right now, mate. But for those of you out there who aren't aware of who we're talking to, Dion, I reckon you'd probably have to be up there with one of the most popular seaplane and general aviation photographers on Instagram, mate. Doing an incredible job, loving your work. Was photography something that came kind of before or after the aviation love?
Yeah, thanks, Dan. And again, thank you very much for having me today. No, I would say photography came second because the aviation thing I started very early with, like as with everybody, you know, from age 5 or 6 or whenever you can recall back to having these thoughts of looking up into the sky and having a curiosity about what goes on there. And then photography, I guess, was more in my teens when I was exposed to that and I kind of took a liking to that. So I would say flying first.
Yeah, right. And I guess some of the places that you go to fly, especially around Alaska, some breathtaking imagery there that you just have to catch it.
Yeah, you know, from photography on the ground is fine. And there's also a fair amount of creativity, of course, that goes into that mode of, of capturing landscapes and people and places and things that we do and activities. But once you get up in the air and you add that third dimension, of course, we're all mesmerized by that feeling, I guess, when we take our first intro flight or, you know, commercial flight. And I think once I started doing that and was in control of the airplane myself, that's when I realized that I wanted to focus my photography efforts and capturing things that I see. And, you know, we all see things different in a different way, and we do things different when we fly. And once I started flying and got my private pilot's license, that's when I started focusing my photography a little bit more on capturing those aerial views and aerial perspectives of what I see and experience, and trying to convey that emotion of what it is like to be up in the air.
Do you do any flying where you're not the photographer, where you're just the pilot and there's an actual photographer down the back there as well?
Yeah. So you could probably think of those as photo flights or flights for the purpose of photography specifically. So, you know, there's a fair amount of flying that I've done in the past where that's the scenario, either for hire or just with, you know, friends in the back, and where I'm not photographing while I'm flying. I'm in any case not doing that. So whenever I'm filming, I'd be sitting in the right seat or I'd be not at the controls. And so the stuff that you see me capture or, you know, share out there is done in that way. Okay. But there is some advertising flying and with film crews in the airplane. And that's also a lot of fun, because having a keen eye for what I think is useful and will make a good representation from an air, especially if it's air to ground stuff, having a film crew in the back and then also being the pilot and kind of adding my little bit of what I think is a good angle and views and perspectives, that helps a lot, because then the team dynamic becomes way more efficient. And I'm not just a pilot, I'm actually a pilot that has kind of an eye for photography as well.
Yeah, you must be definitely the pilot of choice when those photographers come and do their aerial flight, because I know exactly what you mean, where you when you are the photographer as well, and you know how to get the best picture or what the best picture is, you're definitely going to be, like I said, the pilot of choice to put the aeroplane in that spot to get the best photo.
Yeah, that's fun kind of flying, because you're out there essentially scouting and exploring, and especially if the purpose of the photography is just to do some amateur stuff or you know, get the photographers to do an aerial safari. We've had some flights last summer in Alaska where we had to cut the trip short due to weather. And then, of course, when the photo team wanted to reschedule, they insisted that they wanted to go fly with me again, just because of the familiarity with the team already. But also the way I flew, I guess, I showed them different angles of the glaciers and, you know, setting up relative to the lighting conditions. So, yeah, it helps.
Is a lot of the flying with the photography in Alaska that you're doing there, you're talking about, is it doors off as well? Because obviously that's the best way to get those crisp pictures.
Yeah, it depends.
But you're in Alaska and you don't want the airflow to get through, I imagine.
It varies. It depends on the assignment. Most of the commercial operation that we do, that I've done in Alaska for tour operations and air taxis, we keep the doors on just because we're operating mostly cargo and people and passenger services. And every now and then the doors would come off. But we do that depending on the mission. And especially with helicopter flying, of course, doors off is just the better way to fly. In any case, it makes it feel more natural. And being the pilot in a helicopter with doors off is just the best kind of flying. It almost feels like a little bit of a, you know, paraglider situation with a huge motor.
Absolutely. No, my wife's a commercial helicopter pilot as well. So had a fair few trips with her with the doors off, and very good fun. Now, mate, like I said before, there's been a few podcasts that have come out with you as a special guest, and I've had to listen to mainly all of them. And I love your story. And look, for those people who are well aware of who you are and what you've done in the past, they will obviously know that. But for those who don't, can you just give us a quick summary of your background and how aviation didn't come, you know, at the young age like it does for most people?
Yeah, thanks for asking that. So I did not grow up in aviation. I wasn't exposed to aviation in the way that many people have the privilege to do, you know, from a young age, or being having aviation people in the family. So none of my family was involved with aviation. And it wasn't until I completed my studies, went to university, got my sciences degrees, and then I started working, and I finally, you know, saved up. I worked a good many years to save up so that I can go try this thing called flying. But I had always had this love of wanting to fly. It's just that I was never able to afford it just because of the cost. And so I worked my first job probably 5 years or so, finally saved up enough cash that I could put towards a license. And that's when I went and got my fixed wing private pilot's license. But then I pursued my career in technology. I'm qualified in the sciences and computer science and physics and math and all of that. And I built a career doing that, doing my trade, which is large-scale computing and cloud systems, and you know, which is the buzzword today. But, you know, it's essentially large-scale compute grids. And with the arrival of the internet, it was all about networking and e-commerce. And so my career was mainly focused on that, and flying was a hobby. And it wasn't until a little bit later when I, you know, was looking for a different challenge. And we go through things in our careers where we want to continue to learn. And I guess my curiosity about technology was kind of saturated, because the world of technology today is about networking devices and, you know, enabling the world to transact differently and entertain differently. And it's a lot of fun, but I kind of felt the missing component was kind of the reward of seeing the impact and experiencing the impact that you make to people's lives every day. And I wasn't in a profession where I was a healthcare professional or, you know, in the service industry so much. So technology is a little bit removed from the day-to-day. Anyway, so back to flying, I put a lot of effort into qualifying myself to be a commercial seaplane pilot, also did a helicopter rating along the way. And it was mainly driven by this motivation to get more out of the flying thing that I, you know, had started as a hobby. And it kind of built the desire to be outside and have an adventure lifestyle, or a more adventurous lifestyle than I could afford doing the thing that I did, which was sitting in an office indoors almost 24/7. And every now and then, you know, you get to take a break from that and you go on 2 or 3 weeks vacation and you top up on your desire to be outside and have some adventure, and then back to the office, and kind of that routine kind of got boring, which is when I decided to invest some time and effort into, you know, becoming qualified. And float flying and seaplane flying has always been a dream ever since I started realizing how flying in remote places is enabled, and kind of the bush flying concept and out in Asia and remote places like some of the Alaska and the North America parts of the world. And I decided that I wanted to fly floats. I wanted to be out there because of the lifestyle, the adventurous lifestyle out there, and which is what I did.
Absolutely. It's a great story. I love those stories of people who have those past careers and they just look at aviation and they bite the bullet and go out and, you know, get it done. So, you know, well done to you for doing that. And I'm sure you're reaping the rewards of changing that career there. But so talk about the floats there. Where did you get your float plane endorsement, and or how was it to be a float pilot after ticking that off?
So relatively early on in my commercial training, I should say, is when I started, you know, I always knew that I'll get this done. It's just a matter of time. And the US, under the FAA system, you can do an add-on under, which is a rating under the private pilot's certificate or the commercial or the ATP. And so I was on the track to accomplish my commercial ratings. And so I kind of postponed the seaplane test or the evaluation and the actual add-on test until I was qualified as a commercial pilot. But in the meantime, I started jumping in the cockpit of float planes here, there, everywhere. And of course, with instructors, because at the time I didn't have a rating. So I guess I think the first few exposures was a little bit in Seattle with Kenmore. You know, these guys operate just a fantastic operation out of Seattle, and then they serve.
Yeah, amazing looking company.
Yeah, they serve the islands out there. And so they also, as part of what they do, they offer seaplane training. So I flew a little bit with them, Super Cub here and there, and just splashing around, and obviously knew that from the first moment that this is so much fun and I will definitely be on track to get it accomplished. Then I flew a little bit of floats in Alaska, you know, jumping with friends, and I completed a, which was kind of a really nice introduction to float flying, a ferry flight with a dear friend, Rob Galloway, who owns a also a commercial operation out of Florida. Anyway, he was ferrying a 206 that he was newly acquired out of Alaska, and I participated in the ferry flight from Alaska to Florida, which is really a cross-continent flight. And we were on an amphibian, but we operated it for the most part as a straight floats system wherever we could get to fresh water. And so with his instruction and his guidance, I built a little bit of time in the 206. And Jack Brown's. I think I spent some time at Jack Brown's in Florida and did just a little bit of a fun flight there with him. But when it came time to complete the rating, I went back to Rob and his operation in Orlando. And that's where I finally completed my commercial seaplane endorsement. Now, in the FAA system, it's an add-on license. It's a rating. So it involves a little bit of ground and, of course, the training, and then also a check ride with a DP, a designated pilot examiner. So it's the same procedure from a flight evaluation perspective as a check ride, like a PPL or a commercial ride or a multi.
Yeah, very interesting. Mate, just stepping back onto that that ferry flight there. Now, you said it was an amphibian and you flew it like a straight float 206. So was that just to expose to more water? And were you organizing fuel stops at those lake stop-offs, or did you carry some extra fuel in jerrys, for example? How did that all work?
Yeah, we tried to, for the most part in Alaska, we tried to operate it as straight floats. So we would obviously favor freshwater stops. And of course, there was a mix of runway stops and water. But for the most part, the pieces in Alaska and then one or two in the mainland in the 48 states, we preferred to stop at fuel. We never carried fuel with us. We would stop at operators that have bases around the area and that also can supply fuel. And so we would make use of those places to get some fuel.
How many days was that trip?
We planned, you know, as all of these things, especially Alaska, is all weather dependent. So we really lucked out with good weather. We're on the road for little over 2 weeks.
Oh, wow.
And we really weren't in a big rush. We were out to obviously get back to Florida, but we also were out for the adventure and the experience. So we flew all along the coast. We lucked out with the weather so we could track along the coastline, which is just spectacular. The Southeast Alaska coastline between Anchorage down to Vancouver and Seattle area is some of the most scenic coastlines anywhere in the world. And it is unique. It's not just the coastline. It's unique because of the ice fields and the marine glaciers and the topology of what goes on with the mountain regions in that part of the world. If you're looking at a map of the world, the Patagonia has very similar kind of mountainous landscapes up to the coastline. And the Scandinavian west coast, Norway, with the ocean, with lots of fjords and but out of those three areas, I think the Alaska coastline has the most dramatic scenery and the most ice accumulation and ice fields. Of course, Greenland also, but that coastline, if you ever have the opportunity, is just an incredible adventure. And if you're doing it on floats, of course, that's the way to experience a coastline like that because of the access to the water.
I think every float pilot always dreams about flying in Alaska, and mate, I think you've just by explaining that there, you've just put it on my bucket list. I think I've got to get over there for sure and come check it out with you in a float plane.
Yeah, you could spend a lifetime there, I guess, in the Southeast. You know, when the weather does clear on that coastline, it's one of the most spectacular places in the world that I've ever experienced. And from a float flying perspective, it's just incredible scenery. And nonstop, and also, of course, a lot of fresh water. But yeah, that trip, back to the trip, to a little over 2 weeks, I guess. And I think we burnt about 50, 60 hours of flight time. So it wasn't a straight shot, and we weren't in a rush to get back. So we did a little bit of detours here and there and stopped at some scenic places. That was a really, really great experience. And so what that did for me was get me kind of settled into the rhythm of being in the saddle in a seaplane. And, you know, having the luxury of amphibians configuration is, of course, great. But by the time I took my commercial check ride, I think I had probably about 60 hours already in the cockpit.
Now, what a great experience. And that would have definitely got the bug ticking away at you to get into and get that float rating done for sure.
Oh, and that trip, I can tell you that, you know, exposing myself and putting myself out there and doing that, I burnt 2 weeks of vacation, which, you know, is a very sought after commodity, especially if you're in a full-time job doing something else. I just committed 2 weeks of my time and said, this is an experience that I really want for myself. And I'm so curious about what it would be like. And that was also one of the data points that eventually then really helped me make that tough decision to change my career. And, you know, I went back, obviously took stock and assessed what had just happened. And like I said, that really was a key activity and a key decision point for me to change, finally make the step, take the leap and change into aviation.
Yeah, and what an incredible, like, who wouldn't want to, you know, put 2 weeks on hold for that or take 2 weeks of vacation to do a trip like that? I mean, as pilots, I think sometimes we forget how unique and how amazing what we do for a day job is, you know. Like, you know, people go on a cruise ship for 2 weeks and they say it's the holiday of their life. You know, you've just flown from one side of the United States to the other on an amphibian seaplane with a mate of yours over 2 weeks. Like, that, it's out of this world how cool that is. But I think as pilots, we all just think, oh, he's just on a ferry flight. You know what I mean? Like,
it's people do those ferry flights day in and day out. I mean, it's not a very unique kind of a flight. But for me and where I was coming from, I had made it into this adventure of a lifetime almost. I had never done something like that. I was always curious about all the elements of what it would take to complete a mission like that. And to me, it was this total adventurous, off-the-grid, survival, semi-survival. All the elements of what will test you as a pilot are definitely present there. And then, of course, you know, in some of the most spectacular scenery anywhere in the world, like, yeah, sign me up anytime.
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know if you've got up to my episode with Michael Smith just yet. In my podcast, I think it was episode number 14, I believe, and you know, Michael did an around the world adventure in a Sea Ray.
Oh, the Sea Ray, yeah. I did not listen to that. I know of his flight, but I haven't listened to that particular episode.
It's just incredible, and the fact that he did it to retrace the steps of, you know, the old 1930s Qantas Empire flying boats. Just from Sydney to London to start off with, and then decided, you know, to continue around the world. That's the kind of adventure, you know, that you just don't hear about very often for flying. You know, you hear about these long ferry flights, like I said, but you know, yourself and Michael there, you know, taking advantage of these long trips and really trying to soak in everything around you as you go.
Yeah, especially if you have a little bit of time on your side and you can customize the trip into an adventure. I mean, it's well worth the time and effort. And so, yeah, it's always a decision we make. We're trading off, you know, risk and reward, and we're trading off putting things on hold to go do this other thing. And that was a key deciding, like I said, point for me.
Now, mate, so you've got your float plane rating ticked off. Now, you know, how does a guy who, like, well, first of all, what age are you at? Are we talking at this stage?
When I completed, I was probably I'd have to think about mid 40s.
Okay, so how does a mid 40-year-old who's in a second career now, how do you adjust to, you know, being now at the bottom of the rung? I guess you know, a very freshly rated commercial pilot and also freshly rated seaplane pilot. To then try and go out and achieve those goals that you wanted to do with flying in Alaska and, you know, and getting a start in the seaplane world?
Right. It is an interesting question, and there might be people out there listening and have the same kind of decision-making, you know, process that they're going through. And whether it's, you know, changing into aviation, out of aviation, or between two other occupations, you know, the decision about changing something or going into a little bit of an unknown, and especially if you're switching to a total different career path, which necessarily will mean that you'll enter at the bottom. It is an interesting question in how we perceive the trade-offs that you're making to do that. And a lot of the trade-offs have to do with earning a living, maintaining a lifestyle while you're doing this other thing. And the question, obvious question that comes to mind is, will I be able to afford this? Because you're at a, let's say, an advanced stage in one career where you've achieved a lot of the goals that you set out. And you're going to go from that to starting a different set of goals again. Now, the psychology around whether you're at, you know, advanced and then going to the bottom, you could make that the topic of the things that keep your mind busy in terms of the decision making, or you can throw those out altogether and just treat it as a new, exciting challenge. And without spending too much time on processing and analyzing and kind of figuring out the pros and cons of what you're about to do. Now, to get to the, how did it feel to go from one, you know, established career to beginning something else and being at the bottom of the ladder or the food chain? It didn't really, and it doesn't really faze me, because the reality is, you, if you want to achieve any goal, you have to understand and have a really clear definition in your mind and make it out for yourself what it is that you want to achieve. Not just the activity that you'll be doing and the day-to-day lifestyle, but you have to have a good feeling for the ultimate objective, which is, you know, doing something that you really like for whatever reason versus doing this other thing that you might really like. And so the deciding elements is different for everybody, I guess. For me, it was about, and it still is about, the curiosity and the adventure that keeps me learning continuously. And so making the switch to start this other thing in aviation, of course, the practical impacts of that means that you'll be a junior apprentice, call it bottom of the food chain person for the immediate future. And if you're committed enough, I think, in terms of achieving whatever this new goal is, those things really don't matter, because you're putting in the work and the effort and the energy to achieve something that you really like. Unless you do that, you're not going to get anywhere in any case. So with hindsight, a little bit looking back at how this went for me, going from a mature and advanced career and then well-established to really, really at the bottom, it takes a lot of work. There is no doubt about the amount of effort that you'll have to invest in making any such transition. Now, when you listen to, and obviously I consumed a lot of information in trying to learn about different parts of aviation, and specifically now about bush flying and the bush pilots, which I'm not even counting myself one of, but that's the kind of activity where people go out and do really off the grid backcountry flying and using aviation. If you listen to all the seasoned people that have done this, you know, for a lifetime and many, many years, without exception, they'll talk about the hard work that goes into making and achieving and remaining safe in this kind of environment. And so I was really not under any illusion about what it would take to be, you know, half decent at what that would require, as well as successful in being able to operate safely. And so it comes down to just focus on the work, focus on the effort, and never lose focus on what the ultimate goal is. You know, there's a favorite saying in business about fail fast, and it's become a little bit of a buzzword in the parts of technology, especially in Silicon Valley, where nowadays with technology and the cadence of which with which some of these companies operate, is they'll preach fail fast every day, every board meeting, every Monday morning. You'll hear that. And so you can take that, the lessons and the analogy of that, and apply it to your own goal setting and goal seeking. Is whatever you set out to do, make sure that you keep track, you monitor, you know, evaluate yourself, but also you are ready to fail fast. And if things don't go exactly as planned or in line with a program, you have to change something. And so when you're starting out a new career in aviation, you have to be really, really open to put in the work and also be very open to feedback and accepting the metrics and the evaluation that you put yourself through and figuring out whether it's going to work or not. And so I guess it's more than just, you know, take up flying and become qualified and then jump in the cockpit and go fly for fun. My experience through this exercise was very deliberate in terms of how I evaluated myself, the choices that I made in terms of where I would go find and seek employment and what kind of flying that I want to expose myself. So a little bit long-winded, but the bottom line is it takes a lot of work, no doubt.
No, mate, no, very well said, really well said. That sums it up really well, I think. And I guess, you know, I take out of that as well a little bit that being a bit older, I think, obviously adds a lot to your experience in life, really, doesn't it? And, you know, you kind of go into these things, I imagine, with a bit more confidence, I guess, to take on that mission or that new goal that you've set for yourself.
Yeah, I wouldn't use the word confidence because that's kind of a loaded term in any case. But I would say that having a few winters under the belt, you can pull on that repository and that foundation of experience and things that you've seen just being around on this planet a few years. And I think especially in flying, that definitely helps with a lot of the decision making and evaluation processes and workflows that you put yourself through. It doesn't matter what, you know, model you use and which acronym you use to try and make decisions in aviation. But I think the years under the belt provides you with a foundation of knowledge, which you can draw on. And like I said, you can pull from that experience to try and assess situations, try and assess go-no-go decisions, try and assess people. I mean, what my corporate career told me, and hopefully if I paid a little bit of attention, I ended up managing and leading large groups of people, of bunch of engineers and people that reported to me. And so the people element, of course, is key in anything and everything we do in life, period, especially in flying. So I think I draw on some of my corporate and leadership experience to size up organizations when I choose who I fly with and who I don't, working with people in both the crew environment and ground support and then also customers, people that we really, the reason why we're doing this is, you know, there's a real purpose in and meaning in terms of giving back to communities, and specifically in the Alaska flying is a lot about that. And so, yeah, I think I'm very privileged to have had many years in the workplace and then being able to use some of that and hopefully apply that in a meaningful way.
Yeah, absolutely. Mate, we should get back onto talking about flying. You're teaching me a lot of life lessons at the moment. I'm loving it. But we should get back in to talk a bit about more seaplane stuff. So, mate, what was your actual first seaplane job in the industry?
So I wanted to fly floats. I wanted to, obviously, with a new qualification, I needed to get more experience. And so I had my eyes on a few operations around the world and finally decided that the lifestyle of flying in the tropics or the more warmer climates is something that I want to try first. And so I joined Tropic Ocean, which is Rob Cerevato's company that you spoke with him a few weeks ago as well, out of Florida. And he runs a great operation with All Caravan Fleet. And that's the company that I joined. And they were happy to have me. And it was a great learning experience. And what a great team of people. And so I joined them and I flew with them with all of their operations through the Bahamas, which is where most of their service is deployed. And then part of their operation also participates in the New York summertime season, where the air taxi operation flies between Manhattan and Long Island. So I flew that in the summer of 2018, which is just a fantastic learning experience, but it's also a fantastic float flying experience. And so I for his company, I flew that and then also was deployed out in the Caribbean, in the real Caribbean, in just south of BVI. And was stationed there for a few weeks, which I thoroughly enjoyed, but because that really was the island lifestyle and flying a fairly sophisticated and advanced piece of technology, the Grand Caravan EX.
Yeah, so Rob talked about how he likes to employ those bare experience seaplane guys. Did you get a ticket as a seaplane, you know, like a bare seaplane pilot, and take up that FO position for a while to start off with?
Yes.
And how did you find all that training? Because I know Rob gets a lot of positive feedback about the training that goes on over there at Tropic Ocean Airways. How did you find all those experiences?
Well, Rob put together a really great team for getting his pilots into the routine and into the training system, and, you know, drawing on a lot of his military experience and foundations and the principles of standard procedures and operating in a crew environment. So, of course, operating in a crew environment is a very, very fun experience, and as a first float plane assignment was just a great learning experience. So I think it works well. I really like the way he paced it, and the level of the breadth, like we say, the breadth and depth of what he does, and the way he schedules it over the timeline. I think he's initiating onboarding process works really well. He gets pilots up to speed and certified in a really short amount of time, and then puts them in the crew environment, and it really is a very, very solid operation. So I really enjoyed that.
No, I'm all aboard this, especially being a multi-crew seaplane operation. There's not many around the world, is there, that right, can kind of give you that start with no float experience. You know, I get asked so many times from aspiring seaplane pilots, you know, where can I get those first 50 or 100 hours to be able to then get in the, you know, the left seat of anything that floats, you know. So I think it's really cool what they're doing there at Tropic Ocean with getting those guys who just want to get a start somewhere in the float industry. And obviously you're a great example of that, mate, because now you're living your dream over in Alaska. So why don't we go to there now and tell us a little bit about what you're doing over there in Alaska?
Yeah, so Alaska is obviously the float plane flying center of the world, I would say, or at least that's my opinion. It is just all floats in the summertime. Everywhere you look, every village, every part of that incredible state is on floats in the summertime, period. So it's always been a dream of mine to operate or participate in that part of aviation and that mode of aviation. And so finally, I decided last year that I want to go try that, and I was fortunately able to find a position with a company out of Anchorage. Now, as Alaska goes, it's such a huge state. There's so many elements of the Alaska way of doing things, the Alaska lifestyle, that's really unique in the world. Most of Alaska, most of the population is what they refer to as on the road or off the road system, meaning there is a road to go to your village and you can get to your destination by road. So most of Alaska is off the road system, which means aviation is the only way to get there. In wintertime, a lot of the rivers and the bodies of water will freeze over and they can snowmobile on those surfaces. But in the summertime, there's no way, but not even by boat, because a lot of the distances are so vast that air travel is the only way to get there. So, yeah, I found a position with an Anchorage company. I was entertaining different regions. Of course, if you look at the geography, there's the southeast region, the central Alaska, the south central part, a little bit further north into the Arctic. But being based in Anchorage, I guess, in my opinion, is one of the best experiences that you can have as a float pilot, because the missions are so diverse, much more so than some of the other parts. And so I lucked out, and I was offered a position to fly straight floats out of Lake Hood, which is an Anchorage. It's located less than probably 2 miles from Anchorage International. So it's a central location, lots of air travel, lots of connectivity if you need to get in and out of the state, and just a lot of business as well, because of that, you know, tourism is the main source of revenue during the summertime. And so the float operators all participate in that, and Anchorage is the place to be, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, it looks incredible. Just having a look at it on the map there. So many different spots along the coastline there with islands and little inlets and whatnot that you could go to. It looks like you said, a bit of a haven for seaplane operators. But mate, put us in the left seat there for what it's like to be an Alaskan float pilot on just on a normal day's flying. Like, what are you seeing? You know, what time are you starting in the morning? Like, paint the picture a little bit there for us, for what it's like to be an Alaskan float pilot.
Yeah, so the daylight hours in the summertime is extreme. You know, this, if you look at the, it's not 24/7 daylight, but especially not at the latitudes of Anchorage, but it's a long day. So day starts around about sunrise, or day will start even before sunrise, get out to the dock and, you know, go through all the motions of the weather. If the weather looks half decent for the day, then most likely we're going to fly. So the daily routine will start out with a typical flight planning, weather, checking the weather. And I'll talk a little bit about that because there's lots of uniqueness in terms of Alaska and weather. And then getting ready at the docks. And typically on the summer days, middle of summer days, we want to, you know, get out of there just after sunrise, because that gets us the most amount of daylight time, especially on some of the longer flights. It's single pilot operation, so you'll be flying either cargo or people. And depending on what you're doing, the destination also varies. And again, the flying out of Anchorage is very diverse. To set the stage for the Alaska summertime season, it's kind of cyclical, and there's a few elements throughout the season that makes up the majority of the kind of activity of flying. Early season will start out June, end of May, June, and it'll be tourism, and it'll start to focus a lot on tourism to interesting destinations, but for the most part focused on sightseeing flights, so aerial tours, and or bear viewing, the brown or grizzly bear viewing, throughout the months of like mid-June, July, and August even. And that's just because the wildlife is out, and because of the salmon population movements, the salmon runs up the rivers, happens during those time frames. So a lot of the flying, or almost all of the flying of July, is tourism, take tourists to a bear viewing site, spend the time, spend half the day, three quarters of the day, and bring them back. So as a float plane pilot, that's a very, very interesting and an exciting kind of a mission. You'll meet up with your people, everything is ready, weather planning, and it's a go and we go. There's a few areas where close to the Anchorage area, down the western side of the Cook Inlet, where a lot of the coastal brown bears will hang out, either on the coast, on the shoreline itself, and or close to the rivers and the streams. And it's mainly because of the food source. So the salmon, the bears will, you know, once they come out of the den, out of hibernation, they'll go also through an interesting cycle of feeding and their feeding habits. And they'll first start feeding on the sage grass and the meadows, the saltiness and high in protein. And then they'll start, if they have access to coastal, to saltwater coastal areas, there's some of the bear populations that will go clamming, and at low tide they'll dig in under the mud flats and feast on clams. And then they'll rotate between the sage grass and the clams, and then a little bit later in the season they'll go to the streams and the heads of the bays where the fresh water runs down, and that's where they'll feed on salmon then for the rest of the season. So the flying down the west side of the Cook Inlet is just spectacular on a scale that is really, really difficult to describe. The Alaska Range stretches all the way from Denali, a little bit further north of Anchorage, about 100 miles, and then it stretches down the coastline. And it's a range around a 10,000 foot mountain range, 10, 12, more or less, you know, with just dramatic volcanic type geography, almost on the coast. So from a flying perspective and the sightseeing perspective, as you're flying along a coastline that's now very, very green, and that is just skirted with these snow-capped mountains. And depending on where, sometimes we have to cross through, to the west side of the mountains, which means you'll either cross overhead or cross through a mountain pass. But either way, that mountain range, the coastal mountain range, makes for very, very scenic terrain and scenic sites just along the way. And so a typical flight to the bear viewing sites would be about a 250-mile flight one way. So depending on the winds, how you cut it, it's about two and a half hours of flight time one way. Along the way, we'll pass along the Alaska Range, the Aleutian Range, 10,000-foot volcanoes. That is just scenery after scenery after scenery. And on a clear day, it's just awe-inspiring. And then we navigate, for example, through the mountain ranges, through the mountain passes, and you'll get really up close with glacial activity. You can view glaciers from above. The variety in the landscape is just incredible, with the coastal mountains and the glacial activity and then the green vegetation. It is really, really pretty.
Looks pretty good from Google Earth. I'm just looking at it right now.
It is fantastic. There, just to pause for a moment, the amount of elevation and topography and glacial activity and ice field activity, all of Alaska has more than 100,000 glaciers.
Wow.
Obviously, a lot of them unnamed, but the scale and the scope of what goes on there in terms of the mountains and the permanent glacial activity is just incredible. So on a flight like that, the passengers will see the coastal areas. Coastal areas, those times of year, also large populations of beluga whales will hang out and feast on the salmon as well. So we get just incredible scenery down to a site. We'll land a freshwater lake, pull up to a beach, and go look at the bears. There's a few areas along that coastline. Well, obviously, the nature is everywhere. But there's a few areas where operators will either land with wheels on beaches and to get close to some of those bear populations with the floats. So we ended up going to the Katmai National Park, which is a U.S. National Park Preserve system. It's fairly well maintained, and there's an area within the Katmai National Park that also has a fairly large population of brown bears. And because there is a good supply of salmon and a salmon migration upstream, and so there's a little bit of a ranger presence, and there's a freshwater access to a big lake. And the only way you could get to a destination like that is by float plane. You can take a boat from a close by town out of King Salmon. But this is wilderness. You're 250 miles from Anchorage. So now, as a float pilot, you've taken your team, your crew, chatted all the way, tell them about the incredible scenery, burned 2.5 hours, and then you're there. And we beach. And from the time that we set foot on soil there, is we're in wilderness, and you have to be really bear aware and obviously educated somewhat about the wilderness and what goes on there. So we take our visitors from getting off the plane knowing nothing about wildlife. We put them through a little bit of an orientation and teach them the basics. And as the pilot, once you get out the plane, you are the team lead. You need to make sure of safety first and do all the things that are required to maintain safety both for the animals, but safety for the people as well. And so as pilots there, to visit this particular site, we are required to have a basic level of wilderness training and also bear guide training, which is conducted by the authorities. So to make sure that the pilots are somewhat knowledgeable about, how to behave in the wilderness and how to behave with wild animals and the do's and don'ts of, what's allowed legally. But it's not really about the legal aspects. It's about being safe and being appreciative and, the animal kingdom safe. We are, after all, intruding. But we're pretty much in the wilderness there. And then a typical day there would be to, they have, like I mentioned, the ranger station set up. We put our visitors through a orientation again now, this time conducted by the National Park employees, and they'll go a little bit deeper into the do's and don'ts about the park and how to behave and access and, a little bit of emergency procedures. And then we're let loose and we can roam around and As the pilot, I'm again in charge and leading my team, five or six passengers, and I'll stay with them for the day. For the duration of the day, we'll go to the bear viewing platforms, and I'll answer questions and, you know, talk a little bit about what I know about the region and the bear population, and just be informative as much as they want. You know, some families don't want. A lot of people have done their own homework, but it's a really fun time because you're essentially in the wilderness and you're escorting this group of people that have probably never seen this anywhere else in the world. Probably the one and only time that they'll experience that. And we as a pilot, float pilots, we get to do this every day, day in and day out. And so that kind of float flying assignment in Alaska is one of the best experiences so far in my float flying career, because not only, you know, back to the why am I doing this and the reward of the whole activity, and of course the learning and the flying and the technical challenges that goes with that, but it is really, really rewarding to see and experience the fun that people are having. You know, city slickers from all over the world come and experience this incredible natural phenomena, and to see the amazement and the excitement and the, you know, just the joy that people have when they finally get to experience a little bit of nature. You know, even though it's a little bit man-made and get in a plane, it's not really, you know, wilderness.
Yeah, absolutely.
As far as they're concerned, but they're putting themselves out there. And as a pilot, it's very rewarding. So we spend the day and then tool back again at the end of the day. And the day will end on a typical day, a bear viewing trip like that. It's an entire day activity for me as the pilot. The return trip, typically we choose a different route so that it's not just a back and forth on the same track. So that kind of a day is 5 hours of flying, totally unique scenery. Even day after day, we choose different routes. So as a pilot, I don't get to see the same things day after day. So it's very diverse. It's interesting flying because it involves all the elements of backcountry flying, weather planning, alternates. And on a good day, there's no weather. But trust me, about 95% of the time, there is weather. So, you know, a full day assignment like that goes with, obviously without saying, a lot of work, a lot of decision making on the piloting side of alternates and alternates for fuel, alternates for weather. Go, no go in terms of just not even an alternate, let's just turn around kind of scenario. So that's the July flying. It is very diverse. It's very scenic. Every day I get to do that, I see the scenery and then I see the bear population and they change. It's like any kind of dynamic population system. There's interesting social behaviors with animals. And I learned so much about just the bear species and how they behave, and seeing them day after day, you know, the same population, same groups. It's incredible how much you can learn from just observing them. That's fascinating.
Absolutely, mate. That whole story there just really reminds me a lot of the float flying I was doing in the Whitsundays, you know, doing those 4.5 hour tours, taking people snorkeling at the reef and onto the beach there, you know. It's all about guest experience, isn't it, really? And you're not just the guy up the front anymore who's just flying the aeroplane from A to B. You are a tour guide. You know, for us, we were the boat driver. We were the snorkeling assistant person, you know, like we were the guy pouring the champagne on the beach, you know. And that's what I love about the float industry as well. And I guess to a degree, tourism industry as well, on wheel planes, helicopters, all that kind of stuff. It's the involvement with the guests and seeing the guests really enjoy their experience, you know. And it just sounds like you're doing exactly the same as what I was doing, but in a completely different area, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, if you're about wilderness and really experiencing unique geographical parts of the world, then Alaska has everything that you can possibly imagine. There are parts that look semi-tropical. There's also, obviously, the alpine regions, the glacial activity, the marine glaciers, the extreme tidal movement. I mean, we could talk for days about the tidal activities in and around that area. It's really, really interesting. If I compare the ocean flying or the quality ocean flying in the Caribbean and the tropical islands on a technical difficulty level, if you want to apply a scale like that, the Alaska flying is just in a different world altogether. From a float flying perspective, take away the terrain and take away the weather elements, just the water state, the condition of the water surfaces, and the tidal movement in parts of Alaska is extreme. I mean, and which makes for a whole different set of variables that obviously you have to consider and plan and manage around operating on and off the water. So it is, it's dynamic. It's very, very dynamic. You can have 200 or 300 feet of water go away, not vertical, but shoreline disappear within, you know, the stretch of tidal change, two to three to four hours of swing.
What's the what's the depth difference there?
In the Cook Inlet, which is close to in the Anchorage area, I want to say it's 20 or 30 feet.
That's pretty sizable. I mean, we've up in the Kimberley here, I think we have near a place called Derby, some of the biggest tides in the world, which is around, they can be up near 11 meters on a big change. And I don't know if you've ever seen the horizontal waterfalls through social media there. They basically run on the tide there, so some trapped inlets, basically two little very small, I think one of them is only about 3 or 4 meters wide, and the water flows into these little bays, and that's the only way they get in and out there. And because of the tidal difference, it's like a wall of it's exactly what it is, the horizontal waterfall. So yeah, the tides up there, I'm very familiar with big tide movements, just like over in Alaska, what you're talking about.
Yeah, especially like in the Anchorage area, up to about 40 feet of change. And then in the Cook Inlet, if you look at the map, the southwest of Anchorage is the Cook Inlet, and then it forks into the Turnagain Arm, which is just an arm, and the Kinnick Arm, that the Turnagain Arm is also well known for a bore tide at the tidal, you know, tidal changes. A typical bore tide in there. But you know, suffice to say, there's lots of water movement, so it's really, really... compared to the more southern latitudes, especially the tropical waters, it's very, very different, very unique, and obviously a lot of learning going on there. But that's kind of a typical bear day.
No, it sounds pretty epic, mate. You're selling it to me for sure, and I'm sure there's a lot of listeners out there that are keen as to go over there and try out Alaskan float flying. Absolutely. What, just speaking about that tidal flow and that water change there, for those who are listening who may not have float experience, how does that affect the water for a landing and takeoff scenario?
Well, if we're talking about coastal water, so with the operator that I flew, we did both coastal saltwater as well as freshwater work. So if you're talking about the ocean tidal changes, of course, when you're dealing with the tide going out, the tide coming in, when you're beached, of course, the obvious things matter. Like, you have to keep the plane afloat, otherwise you're going to be stuck there for 6 hours until the tide changes again. So when you're beached and secured the airplane, you have to do it in such a way that you're obviously accommodating for the tide. So if the tide is going out, then you just know that you're going to have to either anchor way offshore to keep it afloat, or you're going to have to sit by the airplane and literally every 5 minutes move it out. I did a little bit of a story on that on some of my social media, and I think I put it on YouTube as well. But there's some of the bays where I would go beach and literally watch the tide recede. And when you're beached and backed up onto the, let's say you're backed up with the rudders onto the shore, you literally have to be by the plane and pushing it in constantly. That's how fast the tide will change. In the opposite scenario, much better scenario, because you'll be floating forever, you know, as the tide approaches. But the problem with a lot of that is you're going to be running out of shoreline, out of dry land. And so when you're beached with an incoming tide and you have people and guests with you, you have to be aware of dry land and making sure that they can actually get to the airplane once you're ready to depart again without having to wade, you know, waist deep. It's that quick, the amount of vertical change in some areas. So to answer the question, when you're operating in and out of that, you have to pick your, if you're going to a beach, a saltwater beach, you obviously have to be aware of what the bottom looks like. Now, of course, a lot of these companies that have flown in these areas before know kind of the known places. Let's say you're just doing a sightseeing tour. And a lot of the flights that we do are like that, where you're the float pilot, go show the people the area. And we don't fly preset routes. We kind of fly a preset region. But once you get in the region as the pilot, if you see a waterfall and you've never been and the conditions look safe and, you know, obviously you've done your pre-flight planning, but the weather conditions and the tidal conditions on the day of the flight might be different than a day ago, might be different than 2 weeks ago. Then it's up to the decision making as a pilot and, you know, maintaining safety, of course, primarily. And so it becomes really challenging to determine and to assess the water condition. Of course, you know what the tides are doing because that's published or that's a known variable, but you don't know what the bottom is doing if it's a location that you haven't been in 2 weeks, especially if it's close to a river mouth where there could be a lot of glacial runoff and meltwater runoff. So try and stay safe is obviously the key. So when you're approaching to land, let's say close to a coastal area, you can assess the water depth and you can, by the color of the water. The water is really clear in lots of these coastal locations, except where you have glacial runoff. The glacial sediment makes it really murky. It looks like cement water. It's discolored, okay. Either grayish or it just looks like a lot of soil in the water. So, of course, it's difficult to judge depth from that, just from the air. And, of course, then you avoid that. But the darker the water, typically the deeper the bottom is. And so we use that, of course, the wind conditions, all of that, the surface wind conditions. But to talk about it in terms of the tidal movement, yeah, understand where you're going, which beach you're going, what the slope of the bottom is. Once you're beached, you have to keep an eye on things. If you think about the tidal movement and whether it creates currents and eddies and things like that, of course that happens, but you kind of avoid that and you pick a straight stretch of beach if that's what you want to go, you know, to go to a beach. River mouths, we never operated on and off the water at a river mouth because that's obviously where a lot of water movement is happening, a lot of bottom, a lot of sand, a lot of build up and a lot of debris is just, you know, where fast flowing water is, that's where you're going to have a lot of debris, especially in parts of the world like Alaska, because if it's ice melt, it comes out of the forested areas and it's full of debris. There are trees and trunks and big, big pieces of debris that you just want to avoid. So not so much the tidal question, but to segue into river operation is, In a region of the world like Alaska, river operation is very, very technical. You know, as if river operation isn't technical to begin with. The interesting thing in Alaska is the water supply is, especially in this region, and I guess for the most part of Alaska, is snow melt. Now, depending on the temperature variance throughout the summer season, you can have days of slightly higher temperatures. It's almost like it generates a supply of water similar to when you have a huge rainstorm come through an area. So the level in the state of a river will change day by day as a function of the ice melt, which is a function of the temperature. Now, if the river is also fed, is a glacial fed river, then in addition to the ice melt, the normal ice melt, you also have the condition of the breakup of the glacial, the toe of the glacier, which typically break up into a glacial lagoon, which then feeds the river. With higher temperatures, you'll have more ice breakup from the glacial, which is almost like a flood state, many flood states that develop day after day. So a river operation is very, very technical because of not only the state, the speed of, you know, the velocity of the water flow, the level of the water, but also then the contamination element. So the faster water is higher and is also more contaminated. So there you go. Yeah. Good things to consider when you're going to a river in Alaska.
Absolutely, mate. It sounds like this podcast is all about, or this episode of this podcast is all about, you know, the seaplane books, when you get them and you read them, and there's just so many things in there that you've got to consider. Well, it sounds like most of them are considered in Alaska. It sounds like an incredible place to fly float. So, yeah, thanks very much for giving us an insight there. It really opened up my eyes to what it's like to be an Alaskan pilot flying around there. It sounds like an incredible place to work. and live. So
yes,
yeah, thanks very much.
Yeah, you can, you know, you could think when you're first exposed to flying in Alaska, especially if it's floats, if you're fortunate enough to operate on and off the water, you realize how much of whatever people try and capture in books and study materials happens in an everyday in a region like Alaska. There is literally something of everything from a flying perspective, and we haven't even touched on the weather and or the terrain. We're just talking about the water state. It's very dynamic, so it's therefore very challenging. And you know, there are operations that'll go to open ocean water or close to open ocean, and of course they're trying to operate in and out of sheltered water and always stay on the, you know, leeward side of pieces of land and stay in calm water. But because you have such a big tidal movement, also you have very interesting swell formations, which, as you know, is just very hard to judge from the air. So there is no, I want to say, there is no landing operation in Alaska, and it should be true for anywhere in the world, but you for sure make sure that you do your aerial survey, regardless of how many times you've even been there today. Like if I'm going back to the river the second and the third time, the same river, the same spot, I'll do my aerial survey, even if it takes me three 360s to spec out what's going on, what's changed, you know, from 2 hours prior. There is a lot to be said for that, and we absolutely operate like that. There is no landing to the water that you should. Maybe some people operate differently, but there is no landing to the water in Alaska that I don't overfly at least 2 times to do my low-level inspection.
Yeah, there's no such thing as a strident approach in Alaska on the water.
Nope, doesn't happen. No. But it's fun. It's just a lot of fun, just so much fun and pretty.
Yeah, mate, I feel like we could talk for hours and hours about all the stuff that goes on in Alaska. I mean, like you said, we haven't really even touched on weather, but we are kind of getting to the pointy end where we kind of need to wrap it up. Maybe we can get you on in the future again and we can talk a little bit, a few other aspects. But yeah, you've covered so much, mate. It's been awesome hearing about what it's like to be an Alaskan float plane pilot. You know, so I really appreciate you coming on and telling us all about that. But mate, before we go, I'd like to just go through a little a final splash and dash questionnaire that I like to finish with people, just like the land plane touch and go, the splash and dash. We're just going to touch on a few little questions there. Mate, start off with what's probably your most favorite seaplane that you've flown so far?
I have a little bit of time in the Beaver, and the Caravan is fun. I would say the Beaver straight floats.
It was that in Alaska as well, was it?
Alaska and a little bit in Seattle.
Yeah, nice. What about, this is probably a bit of an odd one, but what's your favorite seaplane that you've photographed so far?
Because
you've taken a lot of photos of a lot of interesting seaplanes.
Yeah, I would say the, you know, I like this. I like the just the image of a straight float seaplane. And it's got to be between the Beaver and the Otter on straight floats. Is this something special, you know, about a radial and 50-year-old, 60-year-old airframe and, you know, being suspended in air? I would say the Beaver, photographing the Beaver. I haven't had a lot of opportunity to do that. I wish I can get to do more of that because, you know, Beavers are always out working. We're not playing around. So no. It's hard to get your hands on a Beaver to just go fool around and take some photos of or you know, get some kind of a loose formation. But yeah, the Beaver is just very photogenic in the air as well as, you know, on and off the water. So, yeah.
Will you be doing a bit of Beaver flying in Alaska at some stage?
I hope so, yeah. Yeah.
Yep. That's in the progression train at the company you're at?
Yeah, there's obviously a lot, fairly decent size Beavers around, and of course, companies in Alaska, operators in Alaska are very selective, of course, as they should be, of their pilot groups. And so there are companies that will put you in a Beaver first season. As companies go in Alaska, they talk of experience in terms of seasons, meaning a summer season. So typically a first season in a float company in Alaska, the way I've figured it out is they'll put you on wheels if you're lucky enough, and that'll get you exposure to the the terrain, the region, the flying activity, the climate as well. Second season, they'll put you on floats in a 185 or a 206, and then third season they'll upgrade you to a bigger equipment if they have an otter or a beaver. There's not too many turbines around, unfortunately. I think operating a turbine in Alaska is a very capable platform. The turbine otters do really well because you're dealing with terrain, so much terrain. So gets you the spare horsepower. But yeah, beaver is kind of the next step. And that's an Alaska thing. You know, you could be lucky and walk into your first job in Alaska on a beaver. If given the choice, would I want to do that? If I get given the option of first season in a smaller airframe and just get to know Alaska versus a bigger airframe, I would go for the smaller airframe first.
Yeah, I think so.
Just because there's so much going on. There's so much learning. You don't want to be overwhelmed. And even though I have, you know, a little bit of experience in the caravan, Alaska is just on a different scale altogether. So you can be coming from Maldives and the Twin Otter on easy, calm, tropical waters, but you'll find that a lot of that experience does not translate to the Alaskan challenges. So yeah, beaver is next, I guess. The bigger airframe is next.
No, I got a mate who Shane McCauley was on episode 15 before, and he flew in New Zealand, based a bit of bush flying in New Zealand, but has also done some Canada and Maldives stuff. And you know, Maldives, the highest elevation, what, was about 10 meters or something like that in the whole country. and then you go to like Alaska or Canada, and or even south on New Zealand, and there's, you know, over 10,000 foot mountains. So they're definitely completely different areas to operate in. So, and I guess that comes to my next question there, mate. What, you know, you've got like a high elevated lake in the mountains there, maybe a river, open ocean, or something like a Coral Cay that you've probably landed in the Bahamas there. What would be the best place that you've actually landed a seaplane?
Yeah, that's a fun question. I would say it's going to be in the Alaska, a little bit higher elevation, mountain lake, glacier lake. In the operations that I did in Alaska, wasn't a lot of high elevation. There's really no need to go to high elevations unless it's for a very specific reason. So we're not dealing with density altitude a lot, but we are dealing with confined operation because of either valleys, closed on three sides kind of thing. So I think the most fun location, not because of being so confined, but would have to be the Alaska Glacial Lake, where I used to go quite a bit, which is just to the northeast of Anchorage. It's at the toe of the Columbia and the Kinnick Glacier, and the name of the lake is Inner Lake George. It's a glacial-fed lake. It's sizable, so it's not confined in terms of the size of the water, but it is confined because the water is contaminated with floating icebergs. And the condition, the state of the water changes every day because of the contamination element. And of course, winds, there's sometimes really, really high winds, but of course, we don't play a lot with that. But glacial lake landings is just surreal beautiful. It is very challenging from a glossy perspective for the following reason. When you're setting up for your last point of reference over the shoreline, you typically have meaningful landmarks, either cliffs or rocks or trees. And we all know how to size those things. In this particular lake, it is surrounded by toes of glaciers, which is just the top side of ice. And it is very difficult to judge elevation because we don't have any reference of how high a particular ice wall is of the toe of the glacier. Now you can go study that, and you can see that it's recorded as 100 feet or 150 feet. But depending on where you approach a lake, a glossy landing onto a lake like that, is you're flying over a solid surface of ice, which you have no idea. Then you're landing into a lake that's scattered and littered with floating icebergs. You see the tips of the icebergs. You have no idea how tall they are. because there's just no size reference. So it is interesting. It's challenging in a glassy state, but it's surreal when you're on the water and you're floating next to these pieces of ice and building size ice blocks. It's spectacularly scenic. That's all I can say.
Mate, I can actually picture it because of your amazing photos that I see on Instagram. So I've got the visuals in my head while you're explaining that. That it does sound like a pretty incredible place to land a seaplane. So great answer. I'll have to add that to the list. See if anyone else has actually landed there. Mate, I guess two more quick questions. The first one, if you could pick any other seaplane flying boat around the world, to fly as a bit of a dream, what would that be?
I think I have not flown a Twin Otter. I think a Twin Otter on floats would be a fantastic platform to operate with all the capability of the power plants and just the capability of a higher payload. And, so that would be one. Not in operation, I don't think anymore, but I think if there was anywhere a DC-3 still on floats, that would be the coolest, just from a fun perspective. I think that would have been pretty fun, but if that's out of the question, then a Twin Otter would be fantastic.
I did say dream, mate, so we can dream about the DC-3 on floats for sure.
DC-3 on floats.
There we go. Mate, and finally, I always ask this question at the end there, trying to get some advice for some aspiring seaplane pilots, but I think I might aim this more at what advice would you have for aspiring Alaskan seaplane pilots?
So let's say the audience is then either qualified or about to be qualified as a seaplane pilot. I would say the following: all the elements of fulfilling your dream, all the things that you would do to make this dream come true, keep on doing those things. Keep on focusing, remain very, very focused, aim high, and never take no for an answer. That's just a seaplane thing altogether. Now, for the Alaskan experience, I would say familiarize yourself and learn about what it's going to take from you to do that once you eventually arrive at a place where you're capable of doing that. And that would mean take many trips to Alaska. Go to that place where you think, which is Alaska in this, go to that place. Look at the lifestyle, the everyday. Put yourself out there. Go find an assignment that might not even be, in the cockpit. It might just be a dock hand or helping at a seaplane company in Alaska. These are all seasonal jobs. It's a relatively short season, so you're not committing half your life away. But the way Alaska operates from an aviation perspective is you have to put yourself out there, meaning you have to physically be in Alaska. It's unlike any other place that I know of where you can be exploring job opportunities, conducting an interview over the phone. It's just not the way Alaska operates. Alaska, you have to physically show up. You have to obviously show and be ready and qualified and show your enthusiasm and be committed to want to be there. The first thing that Alaskan employers, whether it's tourism or whether it's in aviation, and I would say that very true for aviation, one of the first questions you would probably get is, why do you want to be here? What makes you want to be here? And the reason why they're kind of testing the applicant in that way is it takes a serious commitment at a personal level to want to live and operate. And even though it's seasonal in a place like Alaska, it's very demanding from a energy and a, flying the technical elements, but it is a very demanding environment. So it's not for everybody. It's not as if you buy a plane ticket and go have a fun time as a tourist. Places like Alaska takes a lot out of you because of its remoteness, because of its climate, its inclement weather. It's a testing area. And so as an aspiring seaplane pilot, go there, take a trip, go through the summer season, during the summer season, go check it out. Go find a job as a dock hand if you cannot find a job as a pilot. Talk to people in aviation. Show up and don't take no for an answer. Meaning you might go to the same place in May. They might have also be aware of how they're hiring, seasonal hiring works. You know, there's a whole cycle. Become educated in what it takes and what time of year you need to show up. Most of Alaskan hiring happens in the wintertime. It's December or January. So that means that you'll have to be on a plane in the middle of winter, go to Alaska, knock on doors, tell them that, oh, by the way, you know, in 3 months, 4 months' time, when it's summertime, I'm going to be here. Do you want to hire me?
No, that sounds good.
Yeah, timing is key, but you have to show up.
No, great advice. Absolutely, mate. And I've got a couple of people already, you know, talking to me on Instagram and whatnot, who are absolutely going to, you know, soak that advice up, I reckon. Shout out to Emma Kennedy, who's been messaging me about her journey. She's a young Australian pilot who's, you know, only 21, doing a uni degree in aviation, you know, has Alaska in her scope. So, she's going to love that advice, I reckon, and so are the other people out there who want to get to Alaska. But
yeah, the only thing I will add to that is we're living in a very connected world, and so use your resources, connect to other pilots, talk to other pilots that are already doing it, connect with them, ask them all the questions you want, and if you don't get good answers or good responses, move on, find another pilot, find somebody that's already done it before you. And maybe can share some of their experiences. These are just generic things that I'm throwing out now, but ultimately you got to show up and you got to talk to people, and there's no substitute for that.
Absolutely. Very connected world, like you said. No excuse for that at all. Dion, very much appreciate you coming on the show and talking all things about your career flying seaplanes and flying in Alaska there. Absolutely love this chat and really taking me there to Alaska and making me dream of maybe one day ticking the box and doing some float flying so in Alaska there. But thanks very much, Dion Mitten, for coming on The Step, mate.
Dan, thank you so much, man, for the opportunity and have me chat with you and your audience. It's been a pleasure, and yeah, it's fascinating. The Alaska wilderness is just extreme. It is off the charts spectacular, so it's fun to share some of those moments.
And we can all check out how good it is on your Instagram, Dion Mitten, and all the beautiful pictures you put up. But mate, all the best. Cheers.
Thank you very much, Dan.
And that's the show for today, folks. Crazy insight to Alaska with still so much to be told. Let me know if you think I should get Dion back on in the future to talk more about the other aspects of Alaska we didn't get to touch on today. Now is the time to leave me a review if you like this episode of the podcast, and to get in touch to say hi, or jump back to an old episode if you haven't listened to them all just yet. So much seaplane content ready for you at any time, with so much more to come. Before we go, episode number 18 is back in Australia, talking to a skydive, Royal Flying Doctor and seaplane legend, Mr. Lloyd Cofield.
You know, I had some good water experience and good bit of turbine stuff there, but I thought, you know, this the twin and the IFR and all that, you know, I'm going to struggle. I'm going to be out of my depth. But you know, the water side of it, I should sort of hold my own. And you know, it was basically completely the opposite. I mean, that thing is just, you know, can be such a beast on the water. It was just Jesus, hang on.
Until next time, everyone. Thanks for coming on The Step.